In 1973, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz told the nation's farmers to, well, get big or get out. Many of the nation's farmers did get big or got out. That leads us to ask, are the nation's small farms worth saving?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1398th edition of the Food Chain Radio podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Acordalia who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, when the Secretary of Agriculture for the United States of America told the nation's farmers to get big or get out, many, if not most, followed his advice and either got big or got out. The foundation for the Secretary's marching order was an economic principle called economies of scale. These economies occur when an increase in the quantity of goods or services produced reduces the unit cost of production for them. By way of example, let's say Farmer Jack has a 1 acre tomato farm, while Farmer Jill has a 1,000 acre tomato farm. One day, both farmers decide to buy one of those new $10,000 tractors on display at the John Deere showroom. How much will each farmer have to pay for their $10,000 tractor? Well, with 1 acre, Farmer Jack will have to pay $10,000 per acre. But with 1,000 acres, Farmer Jill will only have to pay $10 per acre. These economies of scale are evident for almost all of farms' production inputs, from borrowing money to buying fertilizer to donating to the local politician's charity foundation. Given those numbers, it's plain to see why the nation is left with ever fewer farmers, growing ever fewer crops on ever larger parcels of land. But wait, not every small farmer threw in the towel. According to an AI query, there are approximately 1.4 million small income-generating farms under 100 acres remaining in the U.S. today. With so many small farms hanging in there, when the economies of scale suggest that they just get out, we have to wonder, are the nation's small farms worth saving? Well, who better to ask than Dr. Richard Sexton? He is the professor emeritus of agriculture and resource economics at the University of California, Davis, and the author of Food Fight, Misguided Policies, Supply Challenges, and the Impending Struggle to Feed a Hungry World. Dr. Sexton, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Well, wait a minute. Who's fighting who with respect to your food fight?
Well, I think it's the fight to make sure that we, as a global society, produce enough food in the 21st century to avoid rising hunger and malnutrition and higher food prices. And the thesis of the book is that demand, as we move forward in this century, is probably going to be a lot higher than a lot of the people are projecting, and that there are some significant headwinds to expanding supplies of the magnitude that we need to prevent higher food prices, increasing hunger, food insecurity, and malnutrition.
You know, if just pausing to think about it for a minute, that probably always has been the issue, even when there were just two people on Earth. What do you think? We're always trying to find more food.
Well, sure. And there have been people through history that, you know, most famously Thomas Malthus, but even in this era, people like Paul Ehrlich and so forth have been sounding the alarm that we wouldn't be able to produce enough food to feed a growing population. My thesis is not that we can't do it. My thesis is that we are rather purposefully, as a society, imposing roadblocks to expanding production the way that we will need to avoid higher food prices, malnutrition, and so forth.
You know, when I came across Food Fight, I thought to myself and looked through the pages, I thought, now here is a noted authority on ag economics with whom I agree and with whom I disagree all at the same time. But before we go there, would you please, Dr. Sexton, share your small farm upbringing with us?
Absolutely. I grew up on a small dairy and crop farm in central Minnesota, the type of farm that really doesn't exist anymore for some of the reasons, Michael, that you said in your introduction. But it did give me a great background in agriculture, because in addition to producing milk, we obviously sold cattle, calves, steers, cull cows, and so forth. And then we produced a wide range of crops, primarily to feed to our cattle. But it gave me a great introduction to livestock, crop farming, and so forth. And so, yes, I am a product of a relatively small Minnesota farm of the type that's been displaced through the years by the mega dairies.
I think I had pretty much the same experience in Montana, growing up on the grandparents' farm, spending much of my summers there. One of the things, looking back on that experience, I think the primary crop of that farm was really people, and it raised people, and the people went out into the world and did pretty good. And I was always grateful for the lessons learned while cleaning out the barn, now that I don't have to clean out the barn. But I think those small farms really did produce some strong people. And as a matter of fact, when I was interviewing one of the officers of the USS Dale, a ship I wrote about in Tales from a Tin Can, about World War II in the Pacific, I asked him, where do you get the best sailors? And without a millisecond of thought, he said, oh, the farm, of course. I would take a farm boy any day over a city boy. Well, look at you. You're a distinguished professor of ag and resource economics at one of the nation's leading ag universities. I bet you would have made a good sailor.
Possibly I could have. And I grew up in an era when we were still registering for the draft, and the Vietnam War was just ending and so forth. And so, I didn't end up serving, but I could have made a good sailor. And Michael, you're absolutely right that there is certainly a character building element to living and working on farms that isn't going to pay the bills. But I don't dispute anything you're saying, that it is, it's a good background to move forward in life. And I regret having, I certainly didn't have the opportunities that kids living in the towns and cities had, but it was certainly a place to do some hard work and appreciate the hard work.
Amen. Let's go to economies of scale, which you pick up in your chapter on small farms. Was it really Earl Butz that changed the American farmscape, or was it really the times in which he made his statement about getting bigger, getting out?
Yeah, I think the economies of scale have only become more pervasive as we've gone through time, and so I don't attach any particular significance to Earl Butz's pronouncements. But as the technology has improved, as tractors, machinery, other capital equipment has gotten bigger and better, the economies of size have probably expanded, and you see that if you look at if you look at the average farm size in this country, expanding. Nowadays it's still expanding, but very gradually. I think it's somewhere in the range of 440 some acres as an average. But economies of size have always been there, but they've probably become more important in the more recent decades.
So I guess you're suggesting that the reason that farmers really bought into the economies of scale is because there was technology to buy, and tractors and fertilizers and all of the implements of the Green Revolution, for example, and all of those cost money. And so the more acres you have, the more you can spread the costs out over those acres.
Yeah, that's true. That's kind of the idea in a nutshell. And a great example that I can give you is adoption of the mechanical harvesting for tomatoes here in California. And that happened in the 1960s, and those tomato harvesters really weren't operational on small fields, and so Yeah, and once the mechanical harvesting of processing tomatoes was available, and previously they'd been hand harvested, then that certainly changed the optimal scale of production for tomatoes, because they wouldn't work on small fields, and if you were paying people to hand harvest them, you were never going to be able to make money because your costs would be much higher than the people that were using the mechanical harvesting. So that's just one example in one industry, but it can probably be repeated across many other industries with different types of innovations.
What about your family dairy farm? How many cows did your family milk?
Yeah, well, probably about, we had a barn that was basically the capacity because, Minnesota's cold, and so the cattle had to be inside at least during most of the winters. And so basically we were able to milk about 25 cows, and that was basically the constraint due to our barn. We could have tried to build a larger barn and so forth, but probably didn't have the money to do that.
Well, today the average dairy farm in California milks 1,405 cows. Wow. My question to you is, how did the small dairy farms that fed cows the lush green grasses of Minnesota and Wisconsin get transformed into the big dairy farms in California's Central Valley, where grass is only green for a couple weeks each year?
Well, I mean, grass is greener than for more than a couple of weeks, to be sure.
But to be sure,
Those cattle on those mega dairies are probably not grazing at all. They're being fed alfalfa, grain, silage, and so forth. So, it just is with the advancements in the milking technology and so forth, it's just, again, bigger is cheaper and more efficient, and so there certainly is grazing, but it's largely organic operations and so forth, where then they have to have grazing opportunities as part of the organic certification. And so our cattle grazed over the summers for as many months as they could, and then obviously we were growing crops to feed them during the winters, but it wasn't an efficient way to operate dairies, and so literally across the country, those operations have gone the way of the dodo bird. They're just not there because they. Yep, exactly.
Well, okay, we're going to take a quick break, Dr. Sexton. When we come back, I'd like to pick up the economies of scale and talk about how the specialization of resources and one of many ways that you benefit by economies of scale. But I think it's important for us all to know that this is the way things are going. That's probably going to be the way it is. Stay tuned. We will be right back after these important messages.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. We are What's Eating What? Well, big farms are eating small farms and becoming bigger farms that get eaten by even bigger farms than that. Just like the fish in the sea, right, Doctor?
Well, that's one type of analogy to be sure. But I mean, I don't like to equate it quite the same way. But in a country like the U.S., where farmers have secure rights to their property, then, you might find it's in your best interest as a small-scale operator to sell out to somebody else who's going to consolidate the lands and operate a bigger farm and more efficiently. The point I make in the book is that in a lot of parts of the world, the farmers don't have those types of property rights to freely buy and sell property. I mean, China's a great example where you don't own your property. You have contract rights to use it. And that basically precludes the type of consolidation that in this country has just happened through natural market forces. And for me, as someone in writing the book concerned about food production, not just in this country, but across the world, the fact that many countries in significant parts of the world, Africa, China, elsewhere, they don't have those opportunities. And so, Michael, there's hundreds of millions of farms that are, operating in the world that are only a hectare or two in size. And so, a hectare is roughly 2 acres. And that's a real problem, right? Because those small scale farms, they just can't operate efficiently. But they're basically stuck doing that because they can't consolidate because they don't have secure property rights.
Have you ever had the opportunity to read F.H. King's Farmers of 40 Centuries?
I'm sorry, I haven't read that.
Oh. Well, when he was Secretary of Agriculture way back when, he went to Asia and tried to figure out how these small farmers were feeding so many people. And in China at the time, they were these small farmers who were operating on, like you say, very small parcels of land with no implements of modern agriculture, were feeding the world. And in fact, F.H. King came
to... They weren't feeding the world. I mean, China was impoverished.
Yes, it was.
And struggling to feed itself. It certainly wasn't feeding the world.
The king met this one farmer who was coming up the road, and he had a conversation with him. And the guy said in his house there were 20 people to be fed, and that from his half acre of farm he was able to feed them all and generate a cash income on top of that. And I just think so I think that must have been a very efficient farmer in his sort of way of doing things, but probably not measurable as in our terms. It's kind of like a different terms. But at any rate, F.H. King came to the amazing realization that this farmer was 8 times more productive than the best that Western agriculture could do with the best it had to do it with. And I just, that's always stuck in my mind as a different kind of way of doing things. You know, China has chased all of those farmers off the farm now and into the city, and they've lost that technology. And now they're going to have to rely on different technologies and hopefully a lot of it from us too, right? We'd like to sell them a lot of food.
Oh, and absolutely, we would like to, and we do, unless the tariffs are sufficiently high that it precludes it. You know, which in fact is a real problem, right? Because China can buy soybeans from the U.S. or it can buy them from Brazil, and if Brazil has no tariffs and the U.S. has a big tariff, then they're not going to buy our our soybeans. But yeah, I mean, how do you feed a large family off of a small plot? Well, first of all, you work your fingers to the bone. That's not technology. That's just hard, bone-breaking work. And I know it because I've done it. And yeah, the other thing that's true, Michael, to this day about China is that China overuses fertilizers dramatically.
Yes.
And so that's a whole other way of squeezing a little bit more out of your tiny plot of land, albeit at significant environmental degradation. And so, yeah, I think, small farms can squeeze a lot out of those small plots, but again, they're still not being efficient as we define it, because they, again, have very little ability to use modern capital equipment and machinery. And so, yeah, they're getting by with family labor and significant overuse of fertilizers.
It would be hard to put a $100,000 combine to work on a half acre of land. You probably couldn't even turn it around. But that
no, is the way it would be impossible.
Well, you brought up a very interesting point with respect to, we are now in a worldwide marketplace competing with people elsewhere for the production of basic commodities, farm commodities like wheat and soybeans, cotton, those kinds of things that don't go to the table, but they go to a processing facility to be made into other things. And so in commodity agriculture, it's really whoever can grow the most for the least that wins. Is that a fair summation?
It is indeed, yes, absolutely.
So when it comes to commodities, it's very important to realize and measure these economies of scale, because that's what determines whether you can sell your product less than somebody else can sell theirs. And so let's kind of go through these economies of scale really quickly and let the folks know how they work on the farm. One of the first things that comes to mind is the specialization of resources. So when a farm grows in size, its opportunities for specialization of resources by man and machine provide advantage. So you get more out of what you have to use.
Yeah, no, that's correct. Yeah, you're able to spread what we call, fixed costs, which would be cost of physical capital and so forth over larger amounts of output. I mean, it's very much the example that you gave at the start of the show. And then, again, ability to access technologies that a small scale operator can't access because just literally they're impractical to implement on small plots or, prohibitively expensive because you can't spread those fixed costs over a large output the way you could on large plots of land. And then again, as agriculture becomes more capital intensive and less labor intensive, and a great example of that, Michael, here in our mutual home state of California is, the increasing machine harvesting of crops that, through time up until the last decade, had to be hand harvested. And so again, all of this with machine harvesting, then it's going to increase the scale intensity of those types of operations.
I think a lot of strawberries too, because everybody has been looking for years and years and years for the way to pick strawberries, because picking strawberries is very labor intensive and stoop intensive too. So you have to bend way down to get the strawberries. And so much of the strawberry industry's efforts has been finding a machine that can recognize what a ripe strawberry is and pick that one and leave the others behind. And that would make a very big deal for the strawberry industry. And the other one, of course, is hydroponics and vertical farming, in which you could actually grow strawberries in a warehouse in Philadelphia or something like that. But all of those things are very cost intensive. So you have to be able to have a sufficient size to make them work. And that's what you're talking about, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good way of putting it.
I once had the opportunity to interview Phil and Barbara Hamburger, who have 12,000 acres of corn and soybeans out there in rural Seneca, South Dakota. And their farm, it's truly amazing. Their house was a big two-story affair on kind of a hill overlooking all of these thousands of acres of corn and soybeans. And their office upstairs reminded me a lot of the quarterdeck of an aircraft carrier, where you have all of these machines looking, all of these sensors looking out over all of these lands. Pretty amazing stuff. And all of that costs money, but when you have when you have 1 acre, it's way too much. But when you have 12,000 acres, you can get the cost down.
Yeah, and 12,000 is probably several thousand above what would be the minimum scale to operate that type of a corn and soybean operation. But then the thing is, the per unit cost don't get higher as you get bigger and bigger, right? So what we say is that you have to reach a minimum efficient scale, which for those types of operations is probably several hundred or close to 1,000 acres. But then as you get bigger, the case of 12,000 of the people you were interviewing, they're probably not much more efficient, if any more efficient, than say a 1,000-acre operation, but they're not less efficient either. It doesn't get bad as you get bigger and bigger still. It just basically stays about the same.
So the only benefit then of getting larger and larger after you reach that minimum efficiency level is that you get to sell more crops, and whatever you're making on each crop, each measure of crop is money in the bank.
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay. Well, another significant advantage of having economies of scale are the costs of money. Because it costs more money to borrow $1,000 than it does to borrow $1 million, right?
Yeah, you can probably get a lower rate for larger amounts of money. And, you know, the other thing, Michael, that's probably true is, you know, the bigger you are, the more you're going to get for what you sell on a per unit basis, you know, because there are, you know, benefits to buyers from buying in volume. So there's those kind of monetary economies that are present as well. So what we call the physical economies are the technological things that we've been talking about. But yes, you can probably borrow money a little more cheaply. You may even be able to buy, if you buy 10,000 pounds of nitrogen, it probably is going to cost you a little bit less per pound than if you buy, a few hundred pounds. And so, yeah, all along the way, in addition to these technological or physical economies, there probably are these monetary economies in the sense that you can buy or have credit a little more cheaply, and then you might get a little bit of a premium for selling in volume versus, you know, selling small amounts.
And speaking of monetary, according to the USDA Government Accounting Office, small farms, which are 88% of all farms, receive only 40% of government payments. Well, large farms, or very large farms, which are only 12% of farms, receive 60% of all subsidies. The wealthiest 1% of farmers receive 25% of the total government dollars. That in itself is a pretty significant benefit of getting really big, is it not?
Well, I think we got to be careful there, Michael, because a lot of the subsidies, and these days most of the subsidies are in the form of subsidized crop insurance. That's the main way these days that the country supports or subsidizes agriculture. And so that 1%, those big farms are producing a big share of the output, and those small farms of the type that I grew up on, you know, to the extent they're still around, are producing a tiny share of the output. So it is a mistake to say that the policies in the U.S. in terms of any kind of subsidization of agriculture are directed to the large farms. They are not, but simply because of the fact that the large farms are producing such large output, and the subsidies are basically dispensed on a per unit of output basis, not a per farm basis, that if you're really, really big and produce a really, really big output, then you're going to get the subsidy. And, Michael, the government has been very good about extending crop insurance programs to a very, very wide range of commodities. I mean, of course, they're there for the big staples, the corn, the wheat, and the soybeans, but they've been very good, in my opinion, about making those types of programs available to producers of specialty crops too. So yes, it is a mistake to say that, oh, we're, you know, targeting the big farmers with our subsidies. We're not. They're getting more because they're big, and the subsidies are basically dispensed per unit output.
So essentially, it would be better to say we're targeting subsidies to acres instead of to farmers.
Better to say we're targeting subsidies to output, output. Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
and so the bigger you are, the more output you get, then the more you benefit from these programs.
That's probably significantly more safe than to say that we're giving all the money to very rich farmers, which is what you often hear.
Yes, I mean, they're getting more of it, to be sure, but it's because they're producing more output, and as I said, the subsidies are really per unit of output that they're being dispensed upon.
Well, there you go. So when we get back, I'm going to ask you the big question, which is, are the nation's small farms worth saving? Ha! Okay, this, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson. So happy to have Dr. Richard J. Sexton with us today. He's a professor emeritus of agriculture and resource economics at UC Davis. He's an Aggie from Minnesota. So, also the author of Food Fight, misguided policies, supply challenges, and the impending struggle to feed a hungry world. This is Food Chain, Michael Olson. We will be right back, so don't go away. We're going to ask, are the nation's small farms worth saving?
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, Michael Olson. Yes, this is the Food Chain. What's eating what? Well, as we look across our nation, we see that the big are eating the small, not just farms, just about everywhere. It happened in media, it happened in agriculture, it happened in just about every industry. Can you think of any industry that economies of scale haven't forced into getting bigger, get out, Dr. Sexton?
Well, I mean, my main focus is on agriculture, and the answer in terms of agriculture is certainly no, because once we leave the farms and get into the processing operations, those have gotten bigger and fewer, and certainly there's been a lot of studies that document economies of scale in those industries. And then, Michael, really the revolution of the last 50 years, to my mind at least, has been the replacement of specialized food retailers, the butchers, the bakers, those types of people, by the mega chains, right, by the Walmarts and the Krogers and so forth of the world. And it didn't always used to be that way. You and I might be old enough to kind of remember a little bit, at least in this country, but where you had those specialized retailers. So you'd go to one place to get your meat, you'd go to another place to get your breads, and so forth. And in other parts of the world, it was that way a lot longer. But now, literally across the world, the large supermarket chains have taken over. So, yeah, in the world of food and ag, whether you're at the farm, whether you're at the processing stage, whether you're at retailing, where the laws permit it, the big have supplanted the small, and no signs of that ever changing.
So I pretty much agree with you that most small farmers are just barely hanging in there, surviving, as it were. When I was commissioned to write about growing crops on small parcels of land for the nation's community of survivalists, many of the farmers I met were, when I began my research, had city backgrounds. You know, they're people who think the city's going to fall apart, so they moved to the country and get a small survivalist retreat, and so they wonder what to do with their land. And so that was my commission, tell them what to do with their land. But the people I met, by and large, were very busy, had very little knowledge of agriculture, and were busy losing money and wasting time. And I thought then and do now that if I can help stop them wasting time and money, then what I have to write will be of immense value to them. So my second job was to figure out how it is possible for a farmer to make money growing crops in a marketplace dominated by glass-sized farms. My epiphany came in the pages of the 1982 Census of Agriculture. And in those pages, I learned a couple interesting facts. First of all, whereas the average acre of farmland in Iowa was making about $350 per acre per year in that time, the Census of Agriculture said the most productive farmland in the United States in terms of dollar value of crops per acre was in the Bronx. And the second most valuable was within the city limits of San Francisco, where the average acre of farmland came in at about $76,421 per acre per year, which works out to about $300,000 in today's dollars. So I guess that became Metro Farm. How in the heck do you make a lot of money on a small parcel of land? What the Census of Agriculture revealed to me, which was my epiphanies, was that there are really three kinds of farming going on in the United States. Out in the country, there are very large farms growing commodities for sale into the international commodities marketplaces. In commodity farming, as we were saying, whoever grows the most for the least wins. In metropolitan areas, there are very small farms growing high-value specialty crops for people who have both money and a hunger for what they believe is to be real food. In specialty crop farming for the city, whoever best satisfies the city's hunger wins. But in between, there are farms that are too small to grow commodities efficiently and too far from the city to serve the city efficiently. So the question then, Dr. Sexton, is what should be done for those farms that are too small to grow commodities or too distant to serve the city?
Well, they're in a bad way, just as your monologue is implying. Because yes, the way small farms can survive is by being located proximate to metropolitan areas, and then growing specialty crops, produce, and then trying to market them to the people of the city. And yeah, they're probably going to pay a little more, but enough people are happy to do that. And so those types of small operations can exist and even thrive, and probably will continue to do so. But yeah, the ones in between, frankly, they're in trouble. I mean, so if it's people that like the rural lifestyle and so forth, then it reminds me of my days growing up in Minnesota. Both my mom and my dad worked off the farm to support our being there. I mean, that left a lot of the farming work for me to do, which, I did because I didn't really have any real choice and so forth.
When you were that kid working in the fields on that farm, did you look up and watch the airplanes fly over, as I did, and wonder where they were going, and say, "Would you please come and get me and take me away?"
No, it's essentially, yeah. I mean, I didn't really leave the state of Minnesota until I was probably a graduate student in college. And, even when I was in college or graduate school, I came home on the weekends and the summers and worked on the farm, because that's what it took to keep the operation even somewhat viable. So for those people, and effectively, we were that in-between size back there in the 60s and 70s, then, that's how we did it, by effectively subsidizing our farming operations with our own labor, either in my case earning no wage, or in my parents' case, working off the farm to try to generate the right type of income. So I mean, you can do that to support a lifestyle if that's what you want, but it is that's the only way you can keep it going, is if you use other resources, by working off the farm, or if you have investments and so forth, because you're not going to make enough money off of those types of farming operations to maintain a livelihood that way.
It's really, I often think industry is heading in two directions, very, very big and very, very small, and everything in the middle is in danger of being roadkill, because that just seems to be the way so many industries are heading. So what do we do for those millions of, 1.4 million small farms, that probably a million of them are too small to be big and too big to be small? And yet, should we just get rid of them somehow? I don't know. What do you do with them?
Well, it's a tough question, because, the rural vitality – the vitality of rural areas hinges upon there being people living there, and then enough farms and enough people so that there can be retail and so forth for the people to buy. And so, yeah, I think there's legitimate concern that if these middle-sized operations in the rural areas can't make a go of it, and those people leave and move to metropolitan areas, that then you've got kind of this bleak rural landscape. I think that's a legitimate thing. And so, if a politician came and said, we need to you know, we need to do something to prop up these, what you and I are calling mid-sized farming operations. I think you could make an argument to do that, but then, you know, you'd have to recognize that you're subsidizing an inefficient way of producing food, you know, for the purpose of sort of maintaining people in rural areas and, you know, and avoiding congestion in the cities and so forth. And, you know, that's a very plausible argument. You could certainly make that argument that we need to continue to populate the rural areas, so we need these moderate sized farms, but, you know, they're not going to make it on their own, so it would require, you know, it would require some type of public subsidization to keep those operations going.
Charity, in other words, is probably
but we do a lot of charity.
Yeah, there you go.
Right. But it would be charity with a purpose, which is to, you know, maintain the vitality of rural communities and so forth. And, you know, I'm having grown up in that type of environment, I'm sensitive to it, but it's a tricky thing, right? Because, you're saying, you know, we're going to keep these inefficient operations in business because, you know, we need to keep people populating these rural areas. And so that's, you know, some people would say, yeah, let's do that. Some people would say, no, we shouldn't do that. But that's really the trade-off that we'd all have to face up to.
Sure. So there's no real easy answer to that. You know, one possibility that might allow for some small farms out in the countryside to grow bigger without growing bigger is to cooperate with their neighbors and farm marketing cooperatives of their different kinds of produce. I know they're doing that with grains in Montana and buffalo in North Dakota and beef in Alabama, and farms all over the country seem to be combining their efforts and then reaching into the city with social media and whatnot to say, hey, look us over, give us a taste, see what you think.
So, yeah, sure. And I mean, I actually wrote my PhD thesis on cooperatives. So they're dear and dear to our heart. But it's not true that cooperatives are proliferating in this agricultural cooperatives are proliferating in this country. Maybe they're holding their own. I mean, my sense is actually that they're in decline for reasons that we probably don't have time to get into in this show. But yeah, then. There's the idea of agro-tourism and so forth that is say, well, let's have people from the cities come out and see these farms. And so everybody has ideas as to what we can do to sort of make these rural areas and these farms more vital. But, you know, again, I think they're stopgap measures that really don't do a whole lot. And so that, you know, again, if, as a country, we said we want to keep these operations going, then I think it's going to be, you know, having to be explicitly, you know, subsidizing their existence, you know, which, you know, creates its own challenges.
Yeah, all kinds of challenges there. And, you know, the other thing that's really dangerous are ideas sometimes that we can do this and we can do that and we can do this. And we hear a call from the mayor, the person running for mayor of New York City, who suggests that we should have state-run groceries. And, you know, the Chinese tried that way before the Cultural Revolution. They tried the common canteen concept, where for a very small amount of money, you could go eat your fill. And for people who were very, very hungry for so very, very many centuries, they went and ate their fill, and they ate up all the food. And so the canteens went broke like that. So sometimes the ideas we have, you know, to fix things probably would be better left for the market to figure out somehow. There's probably a lot of ideas on how to resolve the problem of what to do with those small, medium-sized farms out there that are too big to be small and too small to be big. There's probably a lot of ideas, but those ideas could very well be dangerous ideas too. So I think, you know, maybe somebody will figure it out someplace across the United States and try things. I know that some of the people we've been working with on the food chain are doing that, you know, with different kinds of products. Like they're combining five small ranches of people who are raising buffalo, and they develop a label, and then they reach into the city and offer real food from that countryside where, you know, those of us in the city would never be able to reach into and enjoy it. So there's lots of ideas, but maybe the market will figure it out. What do you think?
Well, I think you're right on that. And certainly, so, yeah, the idea of families that are producing the same products, combining their resources is a great idea, right? And so if you can create, you know, we in economics would call that product differentiation, right? So if you're creating a unique brand for what you sell and maybe can get a premium for it, or again, even if you pool your sales, you'll probably get a premium because now you're able to be selling more in bulk than in small scale operations. And so, yeah, I think the market will resolve it, but the resolution in many of these cases would be that these smaller operations would become consolidated into something that achieves the minimum efficient scale. And that's, you know, that's the direction the market's going to go unless we put the brakes on the market. And one way to put the brakes on the market would be to say, hey, we can't have a handful of mega farms dominating the rural landscape. You know, we need people living in the rural areas. And so we're going to do something to enable these farms to survive. But I think really, Michael, it is that type of decision we would make as a society, because, yeah, we could think about ideas, whether it's agritourism, branding, agricultural products, and so forth, that might help at the margin. But, you know, I think you've hit the nail on the head that there's a problem with those types of operations, that they don't achieve the minimum efficient scale, and they're not going to be able to compete with the big guys unless somebody's giving them a hand.
There it is. Dr. Richard J. Sexton, Professor Emeritus, Ag and Resource Economics at UC Davis. He's the Aggie from Minnesota and the author of Food Fight. It's a big book about a big subject. Dr. Sexton, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, Michael. Greatly enjoyed talking to you.
All right.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.